You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Today, we are in Oyonnax.
Some sounds there from the finishing straight at the end of stage 11 of the Tour de France, as the crowd awaited the solo escapee Tony Galopin, who won a fantastic victory just ahead of a rampaging bunch. And the voice you can hear providing commentary is that of Daniel Monjas, who has been commentating on the Tour de France for over 40 years now. This is his final tour. Very distinctive voice that always conjures up memories of the Tour de France whenever you hear it. Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard, Lionel.
Daniel, you're basking in this. We're in the shade, but you're in the sun. I suppose you're just, with your Polish roots, you'd be more used to this sort of weather than we are.
You described me as swarthy earlier in the tour.
No, not you. Lionel, where are we?
Well, we're outside a bar / pizzeria in Oyonnax, which is where the stage finished this afternoon. The sun is out. It's been really hot today. It feels like a completely different event to a couple of days ago when the last day of racing before the rest day, it was kind of cool and drizzly a lot of the day, but it really feels like the Tour de France now.
It is the Tour. And today was one of those stages that was, we call, transitional stages in the medium-sized mountains rather than the high mountains. We can be a bit dismissive of these stages when not a lot seems to really happen to affect the overall, but they are really hard. And I was speaking to Dave Brailsford at the finish, and he was just talking about just what a toll that stage today had taken on the riders, looking at power data and things like that, as he had been doing. So it's not a stage where anything is decided in particular, although Rui Costa did lose a bit of time today and slipped out of the top 10. But it is one of those stages that does take its toll over the course of a three-week race, doesn't it, Lionel?
Yeah, it certainly does, and particularly when there's another one like it tomorrow and then there's two mountain stages. It's days like this that kind of really stack up in the bank. There's no real chance for the riders to... You know, it might be a little bit less stressful because there's less battling for position, particularly once the break of the day is gone. But there was a lot of climbing out there today, and the hot weather, just the transition from the cool weather to the hot weather, again, it's just the body has to adapt to that, and it just makes everything just a bit more challenging, I think. Particularly, I mean, on the medical communique today, for example, I think it was Tony Galopin who had to drop back to the doctor's car to have some sun cream put on an old scarred wound that he'd picked up earlier in the race. You know, just little things like that the riders have to be aware of, because you don't want to get sunburn on a sort of healing wound.
I should say that the race obviously restarted today after a rest day, and we will be bringing you later in the podcast some dispatches from the rest day and some interviews with Alexander Vinokourov, the general manager at Astana, the team of Vincenzo Nibali, the yellow jersey, and one of his teammates, Louis Westra, and Christian Prudhomme, Gary Verity. So we've got a few interviews to play later in the episode and a few other bits of business to discuss.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
Daniel, today's stage, Tony Galopin obviously was in the yellow jersey a couple of days ago for Bastille Day, but was today a stage that he won or Peter Sagan lost?
I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few days, and also talking to Peter Sagan's team, Cannondale, and it can seem as though, and we have accused him of committing major tactical gaffes in the finales of races, but I think that's mitigated by a few things, and certainly if you speak to his direct sportifs, they will explain that it is becoming impossible to get other teams to work with them. You know, the other day on the stage to Nancy, the Cannondale director sportifs went up and down the convoy in their car asking for help, you know, asking the obvious teams for help. So that was a day where Slagter could have been in contention, so they asked Garmin. They got a shake of the head and they wouldn't even commit one guy to the chase. Orica Green Edge the same, they've obviously got Simon Gerrans, and a team like Orica Green Edge, apart from Gerrans, they've not got an awful lot in this race in terms of stage winning potential. And they've also got Albasini, who's good on that kind of finish. They said no, and I suspect it was the same today. You know, we saw Cannondale ride on the front pretty much the whole race, very similar scenario to the what happened in Nancy, to a certain extent what happened in Sheffield. And you know, one point that the Cannondale directors made and emphasised was that what happened in Sheffield was completely illogical, because Nibali had gone away and they expected other general classification riders to go after him, and that was why Sagan didn't move there. And you know, today it was the same old story, really. And I think, and this was a point people have been making on Twitter, that Sagan needed to send the message to other teams that he's willing to lose stages, and they will not chase at any cost. They will not hand stage victories to other riders, other teams on a plate. So, you know, this might, in a perverse kind of way, stand him in good stead later in the race.
Yeah, I mean, we should explain Sagan sort of clipped away again, as he did on the road into Nancy, where, you know, if it comes down to a bunch sprint, he's got a very good chance. I mean, John Degenkolb was second today on the stage, just behind Galopas, so he's obviously finding his legs again. It is the sort of stage that would suit him, or Matteo Trentin, who was third. But you would think that Sagan probably has the beating of those guys. Maybe not. It would be close. I mean, he got away with this little group in the closing stages with Kwiatkowski. It was quite a strange group, wasn't it? Michael Rogers, Kwiatkowski. Who else was it in that group again? There was somebody else. Jan Bakalans.
Yeah, but you know, Quickstep are another team without Cavendish there. You know, they've got Trentin, they've got Bakalans, they've got Kwiatkowski, all fast riders, all riders who could win on finales like today, but they're not willing to shoulder any of the burden for the chase. And it's something that Cannondale have needed to do, probably, to show other teams that, you know, they won't do the work for everyone else. They've done it again today and they've lost, but there was a moment with about a kilometre to go where the Galopin was down the road, and Sagan just sat up and said, "No, that's enough now. I'm not gonna keep working, and you're gonna." And, you know, the message really was addressed to Kwiatkowski, who is an old rival of his from junior races in Czech Republic and Poland. And the message to Kwiatkowski was, "No, you know, you're going to lose this stage. I'm going to lose this stage. But people have got to stop riding to make him lose, and they've got to start focusing on winning stages themselves."
Take nothing away from Tony Galopin, though, and his victory today shows that when riders get on a roll and they have a taste of success, and yes, he lost a jersey and said that his day in the yellow jersey was the worst day he'd had on a bike, which, you know, lots of people say when they lose the yellow jersey in those circumstances. But to come out firing again after the rest day, and just he could afford to take that move simply because he had nothing to lose. He could put it all on the line and say, "I'm going to try and pull off a almost a Jelle Nydam style or Fabian Cancellara style late break," and he committed absolutely everything to that. There was just a little look over his shoulder with 350 metres to go, which I thought was a bit dangerous, and he sat up. I thought, you know, it looked super confident when he was coming into the line, but he clearly knew he had it in the bag there.
Yeah, and Galopin is in that privileged position at the moment in his career, which will probably only last a year, 18 months. He did it at San Sebastian as well last year, where he is respected by other riders, but he's not yet feared by other riders. He doesn't yet intimidate people, but he does have this finisseur's burst in the last 10 kilometres or 2 kilometres, and he can go away from quite big bunches, but that probably won't last. I mean, you know, win too many more races like he did today and he'll find himself in a similar position to Sagan.
Kwiatkowski, I've been practicing pronunciation, and I went to speak to him today at the finish, and I didn't. I'm going to try again, partly to get the correct pronunciation of his name, but also to ask him about how his tour is shaping up. They were having ice baths, the Omega Pharma Quickstep team. The only team, I think, doing so. They had a camper van parked next to their bus for the purpose of giving their riders ice baths today. And Dave Brailsford, the Team Sky bus, was next to it. And he was curious. He was having a wee nose around, as he seems to be doing a lot of at this tour, wondering what the camper van was there for. And he's not convinced by the science of ice baths.
No, it's funny you should say that, Rich, because... Team Sky yesterday trained in a heated room, an artificially heated hotel room, to try to prepare themselves for this change in temperature that we were all expecting. This is something British cycling did a lot before the Athens Olympics, before the Beijing Olympics. I've spoken to a couple of coaches of other teams about this over the last 24 hours. Française des Jeux coach Fred Grapp was quite sceptical, and he thought that it could have a very negative effect on some riders. You know, it can take an awful lot out of people, even just an hour in an artificially heated environment. And Paolo Slonga, Astana as well, said it was something that he wouldn't contemplate doing, that he thought it was very risky. And I put that to Dave Brailsford this morning. I said, you know, I've been talking to people, Dave, and they all reckon you're going to be in trouble today, your guys there. You know, you've set yourself up for a fall there. But he just laughed, and I think they were all okay today, Rich, didn't they? They all came in, you know, pretty much where they should have been.
Yeah, some of the Kirienka, Lopez, these guys were, I think, they lost a little bit of time. Not that it matters, and you know, that could be an entirely sensible decision by those guys to set up on that last climb. You don't know whether to read anything into that or not, but the main guys, Nieve, Thomas, and obviously Richie Port, were all okay, I think.
Kwiatkowski. Well, it was put to us yesterday by someone who we won't name that perhaps Omega Pharma Quickstep were asking a bit too much of Kwiatkowski, because, you know, to send him out on the Planche de Belfi stage in the slipstream of Tony Martin, and basically there were times when he didn't look all that comfortable, and then he kind of came in, he'd lost time, lost the white jersey, and it was suggested that wasn't the smartest tactics for a rider, to ask a rider to do that in his second Tour de France, when he could have ridden, perhaps he had the luxury to ride a bit more conservatively and stay in the hunt to try and win that white jersey. He lost it to Roman Bardet, but then to see him up there in the finale today, trying to hunt a stage win, clearly he has got still pretty good legs. He hasn't been completely burned out yet.
Well, that's what I was wanting to ask him, and I'm going to go and try and get him tomorrow morning, actually, just to ask what his tour is about, because he's 12th overall, but is it actually about hunting stage wins now instead of white jersey and the high overall position? I get the feeling that perhaps the objectives have changed a little bit there, and perhaps stage wins is the goal.
Yeah, I mean, last year we saw Kwiatkowski excelling on various different types of terrain, and when you spoke to the Quickstep staff last year, they gave the impression that the tour was going to be very much a crash course for him in lots of different disciplines, lead outs, etc. And it was very successful in that regard. But it kind of seems like that is what he's doing again, whether by choice or because that's what the position he's been forced into. He is a bit of a jack of all trades at the moment.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
We must apologise for the late appearance of the podcast on Monday evening after the very dramatic stage to La Planche des Belles-Filles, where Alberto Contador obviously crashed and was out of the race. The problems with, well, it was Bastille Day, we had a long transfer, there were problems with Wi-Fi, just one thing after another, and unfortunately the podcast didn't go up until early the next morning.
I heard that the drawbridge to your chateau was up. That was also a problem. No?
Yeah, that was an issue, actually, Daniel. The chateau, we were in a chateau for two nights. I mean, the thing is, at the tour, you have really, really awful hotels and really good hotels. And Lionel sensibly booked a nice hotel for two nights that we were there, because we had the rest day in Besançon as well. So that was very nice. But just, I should like add to, that just, tonight just, it's a flipper, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and also our chateau last night and the night before cost the same as a campanile.
No, it was cheaper.
Yeah, but I mean, it was on a par, wasn't it? Once you take
the wine
breakfast
out.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Anyway, we were very touched and humbled by some of the tweets that we got from people looking for the podcast. And, you know, there was quite a lot of them, and some of them were quite funny. Michael Ellerman, looks like the cycling podcast has missed the time cut for stage 10. Hopefully the race referee is lenient and they don't have to abandon. John Turner said, bath time wasn't special at all last night. We enjoyed that one. And Mark, that's at MJS, said, that was my bedtime routine buggered. And there were lots along those kind of lines. I don't know if I might say that. I'm going to actually send a copy of my book, Etap, to John Turner for his as compensation for spoiling his Monday night bath time.
You spoil another one with that.
don't read it in the bath. So, John, please send us your address somehow, and I'll send you a copy. Now we're going to talk a bit about the rest day and how the rest day panned out for all of us. We were all at Team Sky in the morning, and we spoke to Geraint Thomas, Richie Port, and Dave Brailsford, and they were in very good spirits, weren't they? Very different to the previous 2 years' press conferences, where they have obviously been the main draw, the main attraction, and there's been an awful lot of journalists there. So there were fewer journalists. It was a bit more relaxed, and they were in pretty positive frame of mind.
Yeah, they were. I mean, they're not the team at the centre of the Tour de France. They haven't got the yellow jersey to defend. They haven't got that barrage of questions about doping, which they faced in each of the last 2 years. And that was quite interesting, really, because at the end, Dave Brailsford did actually ask the rest of us, you know, why is the doping question not on the agenda? He presumably was prepared for it. Richie Port, second overall in the race. Perhaps a surprise to some people, yeah. When we arrived, a couple of the riders were walking around with plasters on the inside of their arms, which we found out meant that they'd been dope tested that morning by, I'm not sure who, by the UCI or the AFLD or one of the bodies that's authorised to do that. But doping was just not on the agenda at Sky. And then, oddly, it wasn't on the agenda at Astana either, where their press conference was held in a gravelly car park at their hotel on the outskirts of Besançon. It wasn't the most sort of professional setup, was it? I mean, when you think the Tour de France is one of the biggest sporting events in the world, and basically they've set up a table in between an Astana team car and a camping van. There's a couple of kind of, you know, the sort of banners you'd expect to see at a shower curtain ring sales conference in the Midlands, just sort of with all the sponsors' names on, and the riders, Alexander Vinokourov, the general manager, Vincenzo Nibali, Michele Scarponi, and one or two other people came and sat at the top table. Questions were directed entirely to Nibali, and not one of them was about doping. And when you think that the yellow jersey has always attracted those questions, it was curious to say the least. What did you think, Richard?
I mean, first of all, on the press conference, there are sort of two schools of thought, aren't there? There's the absurdity of it being, as you say, one of the world's biggest sports events, and the leader holding a press conference in a rubbly car park, all very sort of makeshift and quite amateur. But at the same time, there is this kind of rough, rustic charm to it as well, which is something we like about something that's not too corporate, it's not too slick, it's not too polished. You know, it's not happening in conference centres, it's happening in rubbly car parks. I'm a bit conflicted over that. The priority for us as journalists is to get to be able to speak to the riders, to get quotes from them, etc. But actually, it was more. There's also a sort of opportunity to just sort of gauge the mood as well and see what they're like and to get a sense of the team from occasions like that. You know, as we spoke about this in the Velo News podcast that we did yesterday, it's very rare that a press conference, a rest day press conference, really yields anything interesting. It's as much about observing as it is about hearing what they say.
Yeah, I think for people who don't go to these things, there's maybe a misconception about how they work, and that they are in some way organised, or that it's a, you know, there's an opportunity to engage and ask a question. I mean, in the Astana one yesterday, Chris Baldwin, the Astana press attaché, was basically calling out the name of the organisation who had presumably submitted a request to ask a question in advance, and all of those organisations, really, television took priority, then radio, then Italian media, and then I think some of the English media, and so there is, it isn't like it's a free-flowing opportunity where anyone could put their hand up and ask a question. I suppose there was the opportunity at the very end, open questions, a couple of questions were asked, but this press conference took place basically in Italian, didn't it, with all of the questions, whether they were asked in English or French or Italian. Nibali spoke in Italian, and that's one of the barriers. And I think in the last 2 years it's been the English speaking press who have set that agenda particularly at the Sky press conferences, not necessarily just English or American journalists, but the Danes, the Germans, for whom doping is a significant item on their agenda.
Fortunately, we have a fluent Italian speaker in our midst, Daniel, and you were there as well.
Yeah, but I slunk off halfway through because there was nothing really to be gained from standing in the gravelly car park 50 metres away trying to earwig. So I managed to find Alessandro Vanotti, who is Vincenzo Nibali's long-time domestique, sometime roommate, and he was just having a bit of lunch, not really getting much attention. So I had a long chat with him, actually, very enlightening. Vanotti is not someone, it's not a very familiar name to most fans of professional cycling, but he was for many years, unbeknownst to most of the general public, he was a rare beacon in Italian cycling, in that a lot like Marco Pinotti, who comes from Bergamo, like Vanotti, he had developed and subscribed to and embraced a system of training which they called ecological doping, and it was all about how to enhance one's performance without using illegal methods. So Vanotti had been doing this for years under the sort of tutelage of a coach called Omar Beltran, and yesterday I spoke to him a little bit about Nibali and Nibali's ethics, and he was talking about how emotional he'd got yesterday morning when he saw the Gazzetta and Dello Sport, Ciro's paper, of course, and Nibali was very much he was very much the main story in La Gazzetta yesterday, and he said that back in 2007 when they were riding together at Liquigas, Vanotti had said to Nibali that the biological passport is coming, and you know, if you wait, if you're patient enough, cycling is going to change. You know, it's in a bad position at the moment, but Vincenzo, you know, if you believe in yourself, real champions, guys with real talent like you will come to the fore. And he said that yesterday when he saw the front page of La Gazzetta, he thought a lot about this and he got quite emotional. So that was quite an enlightening conversation.
Well, I did actually have a word with Alexander Vinokourov, who is the general manager of the Astana team. Obviously, we remember 2007 when Vinokourov crashed early in the race, injured both his knees. As Richard said earlier in the week, that year Vinokourov was bandaged up like a mummy. I remember being in a car park after he'd won the time trial in Albi, and watching Vinokourov get out of the Astana team car, and he was unable to walk across the car park. He was walking like he had been mummified. Yet he'd just pulled out a performance where he'd ridden at sort of 53k an hour for 48 minutes, and it was absolutely staggering. Then he won another stage in the Pyrenees a few days later, and then on the rest day in Po, he was one of the riders on the Astana team who had been found to have basically blood doped by transfusing somebody else's blood. And so the Astana team that has this history, you know, it has a history, as you said, Richard, in the Velo News podcast yesterday. Astana came into the sport to rescue Alexander Vinokourov after half of the Liberty Seguros team was implicated in the Operation Puerto doping scandal, which centred on the Madrid doctor Eufemiano Fuentes. So the team was born out of a doping scandal. It suffered you know, a couple of scandals of its own with Vinokourov and Andrei Kosheshkin, another Kazakh rider who tested positive for a blood transfusion. And yet the questions aren't getting directed to them. So I wanted to ask Vinokourov what the team's stance is and whether we can believe in Astana as a clean team. And as you can hear, English is not even his second language, it's his third or possibly even fourth. But this is his response to those questions.
I think yes. Last year I'm not in the tour every day, but sometimes if you see the video when a normal tour, like Froome attacks, it's a big difference, but I think it's work too much, but we see that it's not coming just before the tour. He won the Tour de France. He finished second in last year before. For our team, we have a doctor in the team. I can say the right 100% without doping, and I said strategy of the team is like this. For us, it's the question.
Do you think then that Chris Froome was at a higher level of performance last year than Nibali is this year?
I don't know. I don't check the every line. For me, yes, Vincenzo is strong enough for on the tour.
Do you believe it is possible to win the Tour de France clean?
Yeah, but if every rider is go to clean, some you have.
You believe every rider is clean now?
I think yes. In cycling, to change it too much in the last 5-7 years. And we see the new young riders coming, French guys is here. And if you see before, for me, yes, why not? If you believe in strategy of the team, I think cycling has changed a lot.
And then I also spoke to Louis Westra, the Dutch teammate, who was instrumental on the stage 5, the cobbled stage, getting the early break and really being a big ally to Vincenzo Nibali that day. And I spoke to him, he was just standing to the side of the press conference, so I spoke to him a little bit about the challenge of defending the yellow jersey and also that same question of, can we believe in Astana? There's still a lot of work to do, there's still a long way to go in the tour. How difficult is it defending the yellow jersey every day?
Yeah, it is not easy, but we have a strong team and we have nine very good riders. Not one rider less or something. We have for all ways, we have riders for flat, for uphill, for in the mountains. We try to control the race and we have a very good leader.
You feel very confident in Vincenzo that he can hold on and win this race in Paris?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Yeah, it is a long way what you said, but everything is possible.
The other question that always surrounds a guy who's leading the Tour de France is about doping and clean. You know all about this from your own country. Can you reassure people that Astana and Vincenzo are doing this clean?
For sure. We take a good program, and the whole program was to be with 9 guys here in good shape. And on this moment, we stay here with 9 fresh riders. And yeah, that's very important.
And the team reinforces that message to you guys, how important that is.
Yeah. We did altitude training before the Dauphiné, then the Dauphiné, altitude training, 1 week rest, and then tour. I was never at home for 1.5 months before the tour, done the tour. Yeah. It is a lot of time.
So this is a result of this commitment that you've all made.
Yeah. And Alberto did the same, but he crashed yesterday, and it can happen. But it's not nice for him.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Well, I don't know what people will make of that Alexander Vinokourov interview there. Obviously, his English isn't perfect, but he was expressing himself as best he could. He didn't seem particularly shocked to be asked that question about whether we can believe that Astana is a clean team. And he did. The thrust of his argument was that they are doing it clean and that cycling has changed an awful lot in the last 5 to 7 years. And of all the people in cycling, people like Vinokourov, who know exactly what that era was like 7, 8, 10 years ago, when blood doping was absolutely rampant, presumably he knows what the landscape is like now. He will know whether or not the Astana team is running any kind of doping program. Asking him the question isn't going to uncover whether or not they are doping, but it's part of the process that we kind of have to go through in order to effectively just do our jobs. And it does seem that the only way that the question will come onto the radar more is if more of the media ask the same question. At the moment, there isn't perhaps the appetite to do that.
The groundswell. I also seem to be saying, listening to that audio, that he felt the question isn't being asked of Nibali where it was asked of Froome last year, is because Froome's performances were more impressive or seemed more suspicious on the basis of them being unexpected, you know, that he doesn't have the pedigree, I suppose, of Nibali. I mean, you can start to argue with that now. We were talking about Chris Froome yesterday. You know, I remember going to the Tour Down Under in 2010, his first race with Team Sky, and he'd come from Barlow World, very raw. He was being given a job to do each day, and he'd never been given a job to do in a race, and he couldn't get his head around it at all. He was all over the place. They were despairing of him already in January 2010. He had literally never had a proper job to do in a road race, and was really not coping too well with that. And, you know, we think now that there was this huge period where Froome was just sort of drifting, and it wasn't that long. You know, it was only 18 months later that he did emerge at the Vuelta. So his learning curve was pretty steep from that point, but he did have an awful lot to learn. He also had, obviously, health issues as well. I'm just saying that sometimes I think there's this belief that Froome really did just come from absolutely nowhere. I when you actually look back, you realise that that period of time that he had with Team Sky, it was only 18 months from joining the team to emerging as a Grand Tour contender.
We'll get Ciro on at some point to put this question to him, but I did have a quick chat with him in the press room earlier today to ask, you know, why is the doping question not on the agenda so firmly with Astana and with Nibali? And he said, well, one of the reasons is because Nibali's progress in his career has been a lot more steady. You know, there's a logic to that progress of his results. He won the Vuelta first, then he won the Giro, and now potentially win the Tour de France. So it isn't quite as steep an improvement curve as Chris Froome.
And as under 23, he was a good under 23 rider.
I mean, his name was all over Italian cycling magazines from when he was 16, 17. You know, if we look at Astana, that the picture is pretty equivocal. You've got Vinokourov there, who's very much pulling the strings. He obviously tested positive in his career. He had strong links with Michele Ferrari, the notorious Italian doctor. Then you have Giuseppe Martinelli, who is the main director sportif, who for years was associated with Pantani, and since then has he guided Damiano Cunego to a Giro win and Gilberto Simoni. But then you've also got Nibali, who from very early in his career seemed to stand out slightly in terms of his ethics. When he turned pro with Fassa Bortolo in 2005, Giancarlo Ferretti, who is the director sportif there, wanted Nibali to be coached by Luigi Cecchini, who's another kind of infamous Italian sports doctor, and Nibali refused, and he decided that he wanted to go his own way, do his own thing. And you know, throughout his career, there have been not extremely sort of strong and kind of fervent anti-doping statements, but enough to make you believe that he has strong ideas on the subject. And I think Ciro wrote in his blog a few days ago on thecyclingpodcast.com that certainly his family have tried to kind of instill very, very strong values in him, to the point that his father, Salvatore, has almost said that he would disown Vincenzo if he ever did dope. And you know, speaking to other riders as well, another director sportifs from opposing teams with no real reason to sympathise or to stand up for someone who might be cheating, they on the whole are fairly confident about Nibali.
I think we can say when Dave Brailsford posed the question, you know, why is the doping question not being asked, why is it not higher up the agenda when it has been the last 2 years, we turned it around on him and said, you know, should we, in your view, should we be suspicious of Nibali based on his performance at La Planche des Belles Filles especially? And he said, no, I don't think so. There's nothing that I see in that makes me suspicious.
And just to add a footnote to that, Rich, yesterday I spoke to Vincenzo's agent, Alex Carrera, who confirmed to me that Sky have tried to sign him on two separate occasions. They tried to sign him before 2010. He didn't go then, mainly because he wasn't confident about his English and how he would fit into an English team. And then in 2012, he thought that Froome and Wiggins were really blocking his path to any kind of freedom in the major tours.
Are there any riders that Sky have not tried to sign in the world?
This is leading us nicely on to our next talking point.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, we'll get on to Lionel's blog in a moment, his latest blog. You can find that at thecyclingpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter. Lionel, stop dancing whenever that music goes past. Find us at @cycling_podcast on Twitter. We're on Facebook as well. If you like us on Facebook, you've got a chance of winning a pair of Oakleys. Find us there, and also subscribe through iTunes to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, and don't miss a single episode. Lionel, blog.
Well, yeah, we had a very interesting chat with Dave Brailsford, actually, on the rest day, and he was in full kind of sports management philosophy mode, talking about how, because of the debate about how they came to not pick Bradley Wiggins for the team, he talked through how Sky went about selecting a team to try and win the Tour de France, and he drew out a sort of mountain profile stage. And he divided it up into what you want your particular riders to do. So the last mountain is your team leader. So you need, you know, that's where that rider comes into his own. The two mountains, the mountain before that will be another couple of climbing guys. And in Sky's case, that would be Mikel Nieve. And then before that, it would be Geraint Thomas. And he actually drew... He divided up the profile of a mountain stage, showing where each rider had responsibility for taking control of the team. And then he wrote out a list, 1 to 9, how would you then go about picking the perfect Tour de France team from the riders that they have at their disposal. But then he revealed that earlier this year, he asked all of the management at Sky, he set them a task to pick the perfect Tour de France team with the goal of trying to win the race overall from the current... The huge peloton of current riders, and he talked us through this sort of idea without really naming any names or going into specific riders particularly. He talked about, you know, there's 6 or 7 riders who could possibly win the Tour, so which one of those is the best, who would you have, and then how many climbing domestiques would you have, how many rouleurs would you have, what would you do to look after your leader in the cobbled stages and the early flat stages, would you bother with a sprinter, would you bother with somebody for the time trial, from the whole of the peloton, assemble your top perfect Tour de France team and assign roles to them. And that got us thinking, and we thought we'd throw it open to our listeners and readers of the blog. And so we're asking anyone out there who wants to play armchair director sportif to look at the latest blog on thecyclingpodcast.com.
Pozzato, first name on the team sheet.
Daniel, are you going to do your team at some point?
Actually, Pozzato, Ciro got some very interesting texts from him today, but we'll leave that for the coming days. Anyway, go on, sorry.
This is a complex idea I'm trying to get across here. People will be losing their train of thought. So, check out thecyclingpodcast.com and look at the blog, the headline of which is Armchair Sports Director. It's also on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/thecyclingpodcast. And we would like you, before the next rest day, if you want, to nominate your 9 riders. It's kind of fantasy cycling, fantasy Tour de France team. Pick your 9 riders for the 2014 Tour de France. Choose your leader. Decide whether you want rouleurs, climbers, time trialists, or a sprinter. And leave your selection in the comments box on either Facebook or on our website. And on the rest day, we'll take a laptop over to Dave Brailsford and we'll show him some of the lineups. And the one he judges to be the best will win a signed copy. Will win a signed copy of Etape by Richard Moore and a complete.
It was a great competition.
And a complete a set. And a complete set of the cycling anthologies. So that's 5 books.
Can I add in there another book, the complete book of the Tour de France by Fergal McKay? Which is a very big book indeed, so you've got a whole library there. And yeah, Brailsford has agreed to have a look over these and pick a good one. So things to bear in mind, just little tidbits that he offered us, things like, without naming names, if you bring a time trialist to the Tour, he might have the engine, the ability that you're looking for, but is he going to also have individual ambitions for the time trial? Is he going to try and win the time trial? And would that be detrimental in the days leading up to the time trial? So think about the dynamic, whether a rider is known as a sort of individual winner or a team worker, and you know, even what type of team are you trying to bring. I was standing by the Team Sky bus this evening and Danny Pate came back and he said, you know, it's a very interesting situation we've got because we brought a defensive team. Danny Pate is a fantastic defensive rider where he can sit in the front of the bunch and he's got a great sense of where the brake is, what kind of, how he should be riding to keep the brake at a manageable distance. That's his forte. With what they're trying to do now, you know, perhaps he wouldn't have been in the team that would support Richie Port. So, you know, think about what kind of rider you're supporting. Whether it's, yeah, the team around Chris Froome is very different to the team around Bradley Wiggins. The team around Alberto Contador as opposed to Alejandro Valverde. So, you know, it's very interesting to think about that. If you can sort of one line to justify each selection would be interesting as well.
Indeed. So yeah, head over to the website and get cracking. You don't have to take into account anything to do with budgets or any of that. When Dave Brailsford set this task for the Sky management, money was not an object, which is more or less how Sky's budget runs anyway, isn't it, I think?
We're going to hear from Prudy, Rich.
Oh yeah, introduce your Prudy, Christian Prudhomme, tour director. You spoke to him on the rest day, Daniel.
Yeah, I don't think you guys were in the press room yesterday. It was a hive of activity. You were.
Yeah.
There was degustation of Franche-Comté cheeses, sausages. Prudy had a little taste himself. There were also grandfather clocks.
We'll let Prudy slide, Daniel. But we were having this chat today about we'll allow Prudy. But this whole business of writers' nicknames, G, you know, instead of Geraint Thomas. It's the policy of the podcast to not refer to writers by their nicknames.
What about friends of the podcast like Prudy, who's just waved at us, didn't he?
Yeah.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
So Christian Prudhomme, Tour de France director, on his way out from the cheese and sausage degustation, I grabbed a quick word with him about the forced withdrawal of Alberto Contador and the fact that now at the end of a first week that he promised would be one of the most complicated ever and one of the most difficult ever in the Tour de France and which could cost the race general classification contenders, we do now find ourselves -2 main favourites for overall victory, and whether he regretted now plotting such a difficult week one.
No link between the two. There is no link between the difficulties and the champions. It's just like that. It's very rare to have two and three previous winners of the Tour who fall and have to abandon. But there's no link at all. There's even no link with rain. There have been rain every day for 10 days, 12 days. But there is no link with the falls of the riders. Nothing at all. Not with the cobblestones. It's just like that.
You are sad, though, to see Contador and Froome obviously out of the race.
It's a pity for them, for sure. But the race will be open as ever and ever. So nobody can say Nibali, even if he is a strong leader. But you never know. There are surprises every day. 12 days of rain, and now the weather forecast says hot days. So there will be other surprise for sure.
Okay. Last thing, a Frenchman on the podium?
That's Paul Simon. I didn't think that, but three Frenchmen out of the five first riders in a mountain stage on a top finish, and not thanks to a breakaway. It's been the first time for 15 years. So everything is possible. Thanks. Everything is still possible.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Daniel, you also spoke to Gary Verity, the man who masterminded the Tour's Grand Depart in Yorkshire.
Yeah, Gary Verity was here in his mustard-coloured slacks, the same ones that he was wearing in Yorkshire.
Especially yellow.
What, mustard? Anyway, he was here for various reasons. Yorkshire towns being twinned with French towns, the three-day race that he's going to organise in association with ASO next year, and I also wanted to know how he'd spent his first week after the Grand Depart. Obviously he'd had a very intense few months leading up to that, and I wanted to know whether he just sort of sat back with a pint of ale and sort of savoured everything that he'd achieved.
The stage in London. We had to get the riders back to France and all of the kit back to France. It wasn't helpful that the Channel Tunnel was out of commission as well, so we had to switch a lot of the wagons and the trucks, the Pantechnicons that were supposed to be going through the tunnel onto the ferry. So P&O and other operators did a great job running shuttles back and forward. So we got to the hotel in Le Touquet at 2:20 on the Tuesday morning, and some of the other guys were a bit even after that. The riders obviously were fine because we put them on planes to get them across, so they were unaffected by that, but the freight and the kit was. We did the stage from Le Touquet to Lille. Lille is twinned with Leeds, and we went back immediately after the stage finish in Lille to Harrogate to the Great Yorkshire Show. We had a stand there, 35,000 people on our stand over the duration of the Great Yorkshire Show, so we're working on that on Wednesday and Thursday, and then had a busy time catching up with all of the emails and everything after that. and we had a full day's work yesterday in Yorkshire and then came out here late last night. Besançon is twinned with Huddersfield, obviously on stage two of the Yorkshire stage. And so we're here today. We've got a formal civic function tonight with the mayor of Besançon, and we're using the time today and the rest day to catch up with our colleagues at ASO, sorting out all the details for the new race next May. So that's basically it.
And has there been a moment over the last week where you have just sat back in your chair with a glass of wine or a beer and just been able to take in everything you achieved and everything that it represented last weekend?
Friday night I sat down in the chair. I haven't seen any of the television coverage yet, and I put a disc on that one of the TV companies had given me in some of the coverage with a glass of wine, and I managed to watch 10 minutes before falling asleep in the chair.
Right.
So that is still to do. I'm looking forward to when it's all over, sitting down in a darkened room with a glass of wine and watching some of the coverage so I can understand what everyone else saw on the television and how excited they were about the helicopter shots and everything, which unfortunately I've yet to see.
Right. Can you talk to me a bit about the race next year? Mm. We've not heard too much about it. We know that it's going to take place in...
First weekend in May is the slot that we've got with the calendar with UCI. So a three-day men's race, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, three different stages. The middle day, we'll incorporate it with a women's race, so it'll be the identical stage for men and women. Start the women's race, say, 3 hours earlier than the men's race, so they can do the identical course. Same start, same finish, etc. It's very important for both Christian and I that we have a women's race baked into that right from the start. And so our job, once we've got this tour out of the way and had a short holiday, is to then nail down the routes, sponsors, which local authorities want to be in or out of the race, and all of that detail. So if you say it quite quickly like now, it sounds as if it's a short piece of work for the team at Welcome to Yorkshire and the other partners we're working with. It's quite a reasonable amount of work that we need to get through, and we need to have all that nailed off by the end of September.
And I imagine you really want to see some big names there, particularly British names.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the successful Grand Départ in Yorkshire has obviously added to that, because a lot of the riders have come up to me and said what a great job it was in Yorkshire, what a fantastic with the crowds and everything, how they had goosebumps for 2 days and never seen anything like it. So they're desperate to come back. They've had a taste of Yorkshire, and the fact that Grand Départ was hailed by commentators like yourself and others as a big success has made it a lot easier for us to get the team. So already Giant Shimano said they're definitely back. And we only need, it's a domino effect. You only need two or three of the big teams to say they're coming, and everybody else follows suit. So I don't think we'll have any problems attracting the big names. And there'll be an appetite from the public of the UK, and particularly the public of Yorkshire, to stand at the roadside again and cheer on these heroes that many of them are only just getting to know. It should be exciting.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Okay, before we finish this Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar, we should mention today's hero, I suppose, Andrew Talansky. Tony Gallopin was obviously the winner and the hero in that sense, but Andrew Talansky has been battling with pretty nasty injuries from a couple of heavy falls. Was dropped fairly early in the stage, finished 32 minutes down inside the time limit, but at one point was certainly toying with the idea of climbing off and packing in, and he kept going. He was in tears at several points. He was in tears at the finish. But a real courageous ride, and he's got another few hard days to come, and you wonder just how much longer his tour will last.
Yeah, I can't recall seeing a rider stop as if to abandon the race and then get back on their bike.
Iban Mayo,
of course,
2004.
Good memory.
He was forced back on by his teammates and team director, but that was in the Pyrenees on a stage that was designed for him almost, with all the Basque fans. But
and Lionel, I'm pretty sure it happened with another Garmin rider earlier in the race, Acevedo. It may have been on the cobbled stage or the day before that. Charlie Wigelius, who obviously has a way with words, because he talked him back onto his bike as well.
Now, just finally, L'Equipe today, the front page of L'Equipe is given over to the tour again now that the World Cup's over, and they've got huge pictures of three French riders, Jean-Christophe Perrault, Romain Bardet and Thibaut Pinot, Daniel's favourite. And the headline is "This Year or Never." Is that a fair? That's putting a bit of pressure on these guys. Not, and is it this year or never for what? Finishing on the podium or?
Well, Rich, I think it says to create a sensation in the Tour de France, which is fair enough. Interesting. FDJ, they're pretty confident now in Pinot's, obviously, his form. He's going very well. They're also confident that he will go better in the high mountains than Bardet, that Bardet might struggle with altitude, that he's more of a puncher, and also that he is slightly impetuous. And certainly at FDJ, they think that Bardet might commit some kind of, not quite suicide, but he might sabotage his own chances by being too aggressive.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that. Well, I think.
Can you want more? I've got plenty more.
Yeah, tell us
want.
More, Daniel.
Well, on Thibaut Pinot, I understand that yesterday ITV, I don't know who it was, I think it might be Chris Boardman, suggested that Thibaut Pinot was going to sign for Sky next year. And that is not going to happen. That is definitely not going to happen. He will. It's not confirmed yet, but he's going to renew his contract with FDJ. Dave Brailsford wanted to create a bit of mischief this morning. I think there were various journalists asking him whether Pinot was going to join next year. He smiled and said, well, there's been no contact yet. And he is a long-time admirer of Pinot, but that is not going to happen. Another young Frenchman might go to Sky next year. That's Warren Barguil, but not Thibaut Pinot.
Interesting. Right, well, we should wrap up because we're heading towards a long podcast here. We are in the capital of chickens. We're in Bourg-en-Bresse tonight. Bourg-en-Bresse,
I'm
where...
I'm in Mâcon.
You're in Mâcon, but we're in Bourg-en-Bresse, where coincidentally in 2007 we sat at the stage finish in Bourg-en-Bresse. Tom Boonen, I think, won the stage, and Bradley Wiggins had been out front for most of the day, and we sat down with Dave Rills for that night, and he told us about a plan, an ambition, a dream that he had to establish a British professional road team, which of course did eventually become Team Sky. But it's Bourg-en-Bresse that we first got wind of that, a few of us. So let's head to Bourg-en-Bresse for chicken, because it is the capital of chickens, isn't it, Lionel?
It's the home of Poulet de Bresse, which is basically moist roast chicken in a delicious gravy. I should point out, all the Poulet de Bresse restaurants close at 9 o'clock, so
gravy.
We need to get a move on.
Gravy. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.